All right, as you can see from the title slide this morning, this will be our seventh class in 1 Corinthians. We're going to be actually kind of skipping around quite a bit in both 1 and 2 Corinthians this morning, so make sure you get your Bibles out there, and we'll be looking at quite a few verses you'll see in a minute. But I did want to point out just on this particular photograph of Corinth, it might be difficult to notice, but to give you a sense of scale, there's a guy standing there who looks to be probably 6 feet tall right there. Two other men back in here exploring the ruins of ancient Corinth, and of course the temple to Apollos that we've shown you a couple of times before. But I pulled this particular photograph for you because it gives you some idea of the amazing wealth and therefore the influence and power that Corinth wields during this time that the Corinthian letter is written, and really throughout the entire Roman Empire. So we've given you the geography there and talked about the shorter overland route, you know, and all the merchandise of Rome, it would seem like, coming through this area. But here, you know, this is just the smallest portion of the city of Corinth. And you realize that it rivals some of the greatest cities in all of the Roman Empire because of that wealth that's coming through that city. So when you're wealthy, that means, you know, the living is easy. But there's also an attendant problem that often comes with that. So as we were closing our class last week, you know, I asked this question: what was the Corinthian church's biggest problem? Do you remember? If I had to peg one thing overall, that problem is arrogance. It's conceit. It's pride. And they would have, in a physical sense, you know, what you would think of as good reason, I guess. They just had their thumb on the whole economy of Rome. The ability then for them to live in nice houses, to think how smart they are. These people that are coming to Christ are coming out of their culture. Every city has its own culture. Every city then has its own particular problems. If you get to travel any, you know, little bit, you'll find out in a hurry how different regions are, the sort of spirit that these regions will have. And in the Corinthian case, it's very clear that they've got everything the world can offer. They're influential then even in Rome because they, you know, get, you know, it's the economy. Stupid, you know, we've been hearing that for 30 years, I guess, yeah. So we spent quite a bit of time dealing with that last week, but we pointed out also, this is a slide you saw last week, what then, for the Corinthians in particular, flowed out of their arrogance that Paul's been dealing with? Because they were an arrogant people, they then come to Christ. They still have that problem now to deal with. From the 10th verse and on through several chapters, what is it that Paul is really attacking? The divisive spirit. I'm better than you. My group's better than you. We think we deserve special credit, special honor, special treatment somehow. And so the congregation was terribly plagued with this problem. So again, this will be the last of the charts from last week, if I get it to change. How many chapters so far has Paul dealt with arrogance and division in this book? Well, I just told you what chapter, you know, we started the class. It's been four of them. There are four chapters that revolve around this one topic. That makes them this topic. Excuse me, here it comes. I've still got this residual cough going on now. We're nearly a month since I got that cold or flu or whatever that was, but still hanging on in there, deep in my lungs. So that's why I'm sucking on one of these Hall's cough lozenges, by the way, in case you haven't heard the clicking in the microphone. All right, so how many chapters has he spent on the problem? Is four chapters. The only other topic that's going to rival that for sheer amount of space that Paul devotes in the letter is going to be their misunderstanding of spiritual gifts, of miracles in chapters 12, 13, and 14. So obviously, if Paul's going to spend such a tremendous amount of time on this topic, and he's going to spend that time first before anything else, and believe you me, they've got some serious problems in Corinth that we're going to be studying now. You know, this has got to be really, really influential and problematic, and I'm suggesting underlying virtually all the problems that they have in this town. So I gave you this list last week. If you weren't here last week or you didn't jot it down somewhere, I suggested that at verse 29 of chapter 1, where it first comes up, that you make this list of references in 1 Corinthians with regard to boasting, the actual word boast or boasting. So we looked at chapter 1, verse 29, and then 31. We looked at chapter 3, verse 21. We looked at chapter 4, verse 7. I ended up with chapter 5, verse 6, and pointed out then, as we come into the fifth chapter, after 4 years of laying this foundation, excuse me again, of laying this foundation, Paul's going to take up this gargantuan sin that there's just not the like of anywhere else, even in the Roman Empire. But something happened in the intervening week. And all it was is I've been thinking about this list, about this boasting, and thinking about the word arrogant, and then thinking about the word pride. And I've decided this morning that rather than going on into chapter 5 and dealing with that first problem how to handle that problem that he's going to deal with, I really think we need to spend some more on this topic. Because not only was I thinking about it, but I decided to do some study. And I was surprised when I realized it's not just four chapters. It's more than that. So add to this list what I didn't show you last week and should have, chapter 13 and verse 4. And then turn over to chapter 13. And after we read this passage, we're going to spend the rest of this class talking about this particular problem. It seems to me to be far more influential and important than I'd originally realized. And so, just want to develop this as fully as Paul does, but do it in a single class rather than just seeing it go by in this verse and that verse, the next successive verse and all the rest. So, add to your list of boasting passages at chapter 1, verse 29, which would include chapter 1, 31, chapter 3, 21, chapter 4, 7, chapter 5, verse 6. Now we've got chapter 13 and verse 4, which says, love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not what? Arrogant. Now, that's the center chapter in a discussion on miracles, which we've recently studied very thoroughly in a dedicated class on miracles. So we'll come to that in due time. In another few months, we'll look at just 1 Corinthians with regard to miracles there. But this love that's defined, as you may remember from the preceding class, I believe is set here because it's the root problem and therefore the answer, solving their problem with miracles as well. Again, we'll leave the miracles to later, but just think about this definition of love, which had so much bearing on how they were misusing the miracles. The last two things that we're told about it in this fourth verse is that it does not brag, and it is not what? Arrogant. Arrogance and conceit are essentially the same thing, thinking, you know, very highly of yourself. And then the natural response there verbally is to express how much you think of yourself in boasting, in bragging. But love doesn't do that. Love would never do that. Because love, the best definition that you've heard so often throughout very many years, I suppose, well, it's got to be Paul's here, but when you want to use just a simple definition, we usually say love is an attitude that causes you to act in the best interest of the one you love, whoever you direct your love to. Love is an attitude that causes you to act in somebody else's best interest. So when you're bragging about yourself, when you're boasting, when you are filled with arrogance and conceit, what rank are you putting everybody else in? Above or below you? Always below. And so this boasting, this arrogance, this pride, this conceit, and this bragging, the first four chapters is creating the problem of division. And now we're finding out, though, it's even in chapter 13, it's back again. And then as I went to look at just all the passages I could find on bragging, on boasting, on pride, on arrogance, on conceit, you know, like that, I realized they were just kind of jumping off the pages. So first, let's understand a little bit more about what this is in an illustration you may remember from chapter 2013. You all remember these mug shots here? Okay, so it's been a few years, been 6 years. And again, I don't know these people, and I'm really trying not to be arrogant and boastful over that, so you see that. But this is one of the most famous examples of arrogance that's popped up on our, you know, radar here in this country in quite a long time. So on the left, that's Jim Toth's mugshot, Jim Toth. And next to him is Reese Witherspoon. Now, nobody knows Jim, apparently, except that he's married to Reese Witherspoon. So what happened in 2013? Very early in the morning, they get pulled over. Jim's at the wheel. Jim's driving the wrong lane. And we're talking about potentially fatal to everybody on the highway. And Reese's wife is sitting in the passenger seat. Here's the transcription from the police interaction that then followed. So I'm squeezing it all on one page, and I'll read it for you, as I realize it's kind of small there. But this Witherspoon kept trying to get out of the car, and she's just being kind of pugnacious. And the cop's been telling her for some time now, ma'am, just sit in the car. Don't get out of the car. Stay in the car. So we'll pick up after all of that. The trooper says, ma'am, get back in that car. I'm not going to repeat myself again. She says, I'm pregnant, I need to use the restroom. And it's an absolute lie. She'll later admit. It's just a total lie. She's not pregnant at all. She just threw that out. Then she adds, I'm a U.S. citizen and I'm allowed to stand on American ground. To which she then adds, this is harassment. You're harassing me as an American citizen. I've done nothing against the law. What's going on here? They've been pulled over in the early morning, both of them drunk, driving in the wrong lane, and what is she doing? Arguing. So the trooper says, yes, you have. You didn't obey my... And she cuts him off with, I have to obey your orders? He says, yes, you do. She says, no, sir, I do not. And she adds, I'm now being arrested and handcuffed? And the trooper says, yep. To which she says, do you know my name, sir? He says, don't need to know it. She says, you don't need to know my name? And he says, not quite yet. She says, oh, really? Okay, you're about to find out who I am. Well, what is that? It's a threat, isn't it? And what's the attitude? I'm better than you. I'm bigger than you. You're just a state trooper trying to save my life while my husband and I are out drunk driving in the wrong lane. But who does she think she is? She's in charge here. The trooper, after he's arrested her, put her in the car, he says to the husband, I tried, and the husband says, I'm sorry. Now, what does the husband get? My wife is way out of line. Way out of line. So how did she get here? Everybody knows. How highly does she think of herself? See, if you don't know my name, there's something wrong with you. If you do know my name, then you know I can do whatever I want. I don't have to obey your orders. I don't have to stay in this car if you tell me not to. You got no right to arrest me. So on a disorderly conduct charge, she sure enough went to jail and eventually apologized. And everybody gives her high marks for that. And if you think that Legally Blonde is the highest form of cinematic art that's ever been produced, then okay. That's fine with me. But it's just this attitude we're talking about right here. Does it really get you in trouble? It really gets you in trouble. Carol, do you have a hand? I was sure.
Well, verse 5 continues. It says, do not act unbecoming. It does not seek its own. It is not provoked. Does not take into account a wrong suffered. Does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices in the truth.
Okay.
I mean, that's exactly what
exactly. And see, and that's why I wanted to spend some more time on that this morning. Because the thing does cascade, doesn't it? It's like dominoes. And she's breaking every definition of love, but what's at the heart of it all? Again, all these consequences are flowing out of an overblown sense of who you are and how you ought to be respected. So, again, go ahead, Carl.
Just an irrelevant television show, Highway to Heaven. Guy says to Michael Landon, do you know who you're talking to? And he says, I'm talking to you.
Okay.
Okay.
Talking to you. So brethren, we just need to know who we are, where we are in the big plan of things. Have a proper evaluation of ourselves and be awfully careful, because right now, apparently just lurking, you know, beneath the surface in virtually everything that's going on in the Corinthian congregation, next only to Laodicea for being the most messed up congregation in all the Bible, is this pride, is this arrogance. So here's another list for you. It's, you know, far from being complete. Pride, of course, comes up all over your Old Testament and your New Testament, and there's a lot that's said about various problems that arise because of it. So I'm going to limit it this morning for our purposes here with just the book of Proverbs. But here's just a short list of some of the things that's already been pointed out in the Old Testament, which, at least in the Corinthian congregation, for those who were Jews, they should have known. Now, it's a Gentile town. It's probably predominantly Gentile membership. But nonetheless, you know, there'd be some Jews there be familiar with that. So, in Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 13, pride, arrogance, the evil way, and the perverted mouth, God says, I hate. That's Proverbs 8:13. Proverbs 11, verse 2. When pride comes, then comes dishonor. But with the humble is wisdom. Now, if ever we saw that perfectly illustrated, you know, it's in the transcription from the conversation that we just saw in that arrest. Look at 16:18, which, of course, is probably the most famous verse on pride in our entire Bible. Pride goes before what? Destruction. And a haughty spirit before stumbling. Now, brethren, again, there are so many verses on this topic in both the Old and the New Testament. But that warning has become the most popular, I guess, or most memorable, because it's just so obviously true. Pride is what comes just before destruction. Pride is what you're going to be experiencing, that haughty spirit, just before you stumble. This stuff is dangerous. This stuff is self-destructive. Soon as you lose the reins on that horse, there's something bad, really bad, coming for you. If you can't get this beast under control, then it's apparently just inevitable. Destruction, stumbling, all kinds of problems are going to flow out of it. Now, again, brethren, you know, and part of the reason that I'm working this as hard as I am this morning, going to dedicate a whole class to it. If you've been coming on Sunday nights, and most of you have, you know, I can see in the class, you've been coming on Sunday nights. We've been studying the life of Joseph, who has 13 chapters out of the 50 in Genesis devoted to him. We've been following ideas by Don Bassett, Jerry Bassett's brother, of course, in a book called The Joseph Code, which you can readily buy. We bought it, I say we, the church, you know, for the teen class, and so they went through it with Dean, I think it was. Okay, so tonight, totally coincidentally, I really didn't plan it this way, but guess what we're going to be talking about tonight with regard to Joseph? Another word that would be very closely tied to this: vengeance. Something Joseph never practiced. But what is vengeance? This is when your horses get loose and now you not only think more highly of yourself than you should, and you think more highly of yourself with regard to other people than you should, but now, what are those thoughts becoming? They're becoming action. Vengeance is when you decide to get things right, to get even, to fix it. This is when the attitude now takes action and now is giving other people perfect reason, now that you're showing this pride, that you would are about to be destroyed. Some people don't care to have vengeance wrought upon them. Some are even likely to respond. Sometimes you may not prove to be the strongest one in the room when this battle's done. But you've really unleashed your wrath now, which only exists because of your pride. And tonight, from God's standpoint, in Joseph's life, we'll be thinking about vengeance and to whom it belongs and how damaging that it can be. So again, I use that word coincidental, but I've seen this so many times in my life, and I know you have in yours. The better word, I think, is providential. And so I was seeing this happening, and I thought, we're just going to spend some time on this here this morning. So it's kind of an extra class with regard to 1 Corinthians, but I'm pretty sure an awfully important one for reasons we'll see not only later in this class, but also tonight. Here's Proverbs 21, verse 24. Proud, haughty, scoffer are his names, who acts with insolent pride. So once again, here's, you know, the additional layer of not just what's going on in your head, but what then comes out in your life. Lose control of yourself in this area. Other people will sense it. They'll feel it. And to the extent that you allow yourself to act upon it, if you're Reese Witherspoon, you make a complete public fool out of yourself and then have to go and do, you know, the apology tour, which, as I recall, she was on for weeks, you know, because you're going to act with that insolent pride in the most inappropriate circumstances. And the last of our Proverbs list is chapter 29 and verse 23. A man's pride will bring him low, but a humble spirit will obtain honor. The world, to me, seems to be self-correcting. That's because you will reap what you sow. Okay? Then, hopefully, when the thing has come full circle, you've met your destruction, you've been brought low, the man's pride brings him low, what's the next word in the sentence? Humble spirit will obtain honor. The world's kind of self-correcting. You reap what you sow, and then when you get put in your place, you've just experienced humble pie. Eating crow. You know, and you've been brought low, You've been humiliated, which means you've been humbled. And by the way, this is totally unrelated, just leaped into my mind. But Donna and I knew a girl now approaching 20, I guess. But way back when she was just a little girl, she was 4 years old, lived up in Washington. They took her out to the coast, a very, very bright, intelligent kid. She's 4 years old. She's out there on the sand at the beach. Hot day, they decide, you know, we're going to go into the water. So she stepped out in. It's just tiny little waves coming in, but she's 4 years old, and she doesn't know anything about waves. So she walked in, you know, the first wave comes in, 6 inches tall, and it just bowls her over. So she gets up, and she says, I've been humbled by the sea. A four-year-old says, I've been humbled by the sea. But isn't that what pride and arrogance and insolence will eventually do for everybody? It brings you low. Just splashed her. Okay. And still, I marvel that a four-year-old would phrase it like that. But at any rate, you know, you're going down. A man's pride will bring him low, but the humble spirit will obtain honor. Now, so far, have I said anything that you didn't already know? Well, no. Have I said anything really that I didn't say last week? Nothing really all that different. We're just realizing how often this topic comes up and how destructive it can be. So, do you get that arrogance and conceit and pride, which results in boasting and division, and then eventually your destruction if you let it run amok, do you get that? Yes, you do. However, and this was the side that was particularly surprising to me when I then just went and looked up every occurrence I could find in all the Bible, you know, on these various terms. So now that you get how wrong, how evil, how destructive, how terribly bad that pride is, what do you think of this picture? So instantly we recognize it. What is this a picture of? Mom and dad and the apparently college-aged daughter on the day of her graduation. How evil that is. They're about to be destroyed. Right? Well, no. You know, I don't think that at all. Is there a thing in the world wrong with how they feel? Should that young lady be really proud of herself? Well, I think so. If she spent, and I don't know the people, I don't know the circumstances, it's just an anonymous photograph off the internet, but you know, I don't know if that's a PhD, I don't know if it's 2 years or 4 years or six, eight, 10 or 20, what she's been doing, but it's hard work. It takes discipline. And when you accomplish something that you have rightly worked very hard for, are you now supposed to feel bad about yourself? Is there some sin involved? Some years ago, a man who was not a Christian, but who I met through the internet because of some of my classes on Revelation, found out in the Seattle area that I was going to be teaching Revelation for a neighboring congregation. So a total stranger to me, he calls me up and he says, I'd like to attend your class. And actually, I had to drive, I think it was 40 miles to get, you know, to this other congregation. But, you know, he says, I live in between. Could you come and pick me up and drive me in? I'd like to attend your class. So I said, fine. Now, I had opportunity then, and many a long hour spent with him, you know, in this commute while I was teaching this Revelation class for another congregation, that I made a comment one time. And I can't remember if I said it about somebody else, if I said it about myself, if I said it about my children or my wife. I can't remember what it was. But I just made the comment, I was proud of something. And you know, this guy just chewed me up for the next hour. Don't you know the Bible teaches that pride is never appropriate? It is always wrong. It is rebellion against God. Never under any circumstances should you ever use that word or feel that emotion. I labored in vain, I never changed his mind. He agreed with me on Revelation, but I couldn't get this bride thing down. Okay. But nonetheless, you know, I never forgot it. He had taken this thing what?
Too far.
In fact, I wonder if there wasn't some arrogance here as he was condescendingly explaining to me, you know, that I could never even use the word without somehow, he was telling me, setting myself above God. That if you ever even experience any pride in anything you've ever done, then you're placing yourself above God. It was a wild ride. Really very, very interesting thing. Well, brother, what about this? Please now, if you'd like, make another list. I've given you passages that deal with the error. Let's see, though, if there isn't an appropriate balance, a means by which we can do what I'm sure is as appropriate as what this family's doing, rejoicing in their daughter's success. The parents are proud of how she turned out. They're proud of how they raised her. She's proud of what she's done. And I don't think there's any sin in that at all, necessarily. Now, come on back to 1 Corinthians now, chapter 9. And we're going to have an equally long, in fact longer, counterbalancing study on the topic of pride and boasting. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verses 15 and 16, Paul says, he's speaking of, you know, some rights that he has, but in verse 15, I've used none of these things, and I'm not writing these things that it may be done so in my case. For it would be better for me to die than have any man make my boast an empty one. Whoa, all these passages on boasting being so wrong, the fundamental problem that's producing the division, laced through all the rest of their problems in Corinthians, and now Paul says, better for me to die than have any man make my boast an empty one? Well, that sounds kind of arrogant and condescending. Look at the next verse. If I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for I'm under compulsion. For woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. Well, the man's out of his mind. Is it verse 16 a direct contradiction to verse 15, isn't it? Isn't that what it looks like? He does not want anybody to make his boast empty, and he'd rather die first in verse 15. But then he says, if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for I'm under compulsion. Woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. Now we'll get to it in good time, of course, here in 1 Corinthians 9. We're only, you know, working with chapter 4 and 5. But, you know, we'll get to chapter 9 in a while. What was Paul boasting in that he'd rather die than have somebody take it away? He was boasting in the fact that while he had all kinds of power and authority that he might exert over these people, that he was rightly superior to them as an apostle of God, he had made the gospel free to them. He had not exercised the rights that were due to him. And he is boasting in the fact, and would die before anybody takes it away, that he had behaved appropriately as a Christian and as an apostle. That he had gone beyond the call of duty. He was exactly what God wanted him to be. There was no fault that they could find in him. Now, is he manifesting arrogance or conceit? No. He is setting the record straight. He wants to get even, if you will. But only in the sense that, as we read intervening chapters, we'll get to it in due time, he's been lied about, he's been misrepresented, he's been falsely accused. Paul spends an enormous amount of time defending himself to the Corinthians in both of these two letters that he writes, and he just wants everybody to understand, I'm boasting, and he's using that term even facetiously, in the idea that I am not guilty of any crime you've charged me with. I haven't even exercised all the rights that God has given me. So, he's not contradicting himself in verse 16 when he says he'd rather die than have his boast be made empty. If I preach the gospel, I've nothing to boast of. In what sense? In myself. My preaching is not my own, it is God's. The very words that he used, were they his own? 1 Corinthians 2, we've already studied it. Every word he put on the page came from whom? The Holy Spirit of the living God. He can't take credit for it. So, he says, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. I had to do what I did, and nobody's going to take that away from me. I'd rather die than have you people lie, falsely accuse, and misrepresent my entire life. He is setting the record straight, but not with vengeance, not with arrogance or conceit at all. He is boasting, but not in a bad or wrong sense. Come on over to chapter 15 and verse 31. In 15:31, I protest, brethren, by the boasting in you which I have in Christ Jesus our Lord, I die daily. If from human motives I fought with wild beasts at Ephesus, what does it profit me? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Now, there's a whole chapter on their misunderstanding of the resurrection, the most fundamentally important foundational doctrine in all the Bible. But he says, I protest by the boasting in you which I have in Christ Jesus our Lord. Now, the way the Greek is constructed, the way that's printed on the page is kind of odd to our ears. But he says, I'm boasting in you. What he means is, I'm boasting about you. Now, at this point in our studies, that ought to be pretty surprising. Paul boasted about the Corinthians as much as he criticized them. Paul used them as an example when he was talking to other congregations as much as he criticized them. He, in one context, concerning certain circumstances and the particular manifestation of how you feel about yourself, boasting can be astonishingly evil. But Paul here isn't boasting about himself at all, is he? What's he boasting in? The Corinthians, when they got it right. It's kind of like these parents over here, isn't he? Well, he's just like those parents. And that could be taken too far. But did Paul ever? No, they've accused him of it. Don't he'd rather die than have that lie go forth. So he's setting the record straight. Now, here's what particularly surprised me. And I kind of knew this and I kind of didn't. The rest of this list, and maybe you'd want to make a second list, a different list, everything we're going to look at now, you can see how much space I need to do it, is going to be in the second Corinthian letter. Now, let me tell you, you know, in advance, what you already know, I'm sure you've all studied this, Paul was awfully harsh in the first letter. Did the Corinthians repent? Oh, did they ever? They responded in humility. They reigned in that arrogance and all those problems. They did everything Paul asked them to do. So when you read the second Corinthian letter, does it have the same attitude or feel as the first Corinthian letter? Not at all. Not at all. So when we get into the second Corinthian letter, we all knew this. The guy we're going to read about in chapter 5 next week, the one who's committing a sin that even the Gentiles would be horrified at, that the Corinthians were boasting in, Paul told them how they were to handle this. You're not going to brag on that guy anymore. You're going to pitch him out of the church. Did they do it? They did. How did the guy respond? You all know the end from the beginning. You've studied 1 Corinthians. He repented, which was why Paul wanted them to throw him out of the church. It worked. He repented because the Corinthians repented, and now that everybody's repentant and they've reined in their arrogance and their boasting when they were using it incorrectly, Paul's going to spend a lot of time boasting in the second Corinthian letter. So when you're reading the First Corinthian letter, you come away with this idea, pride, arrogance, all goes before a fall, you know, and then boasting and bragging, evil, evil, wicked, mean and nasty, is just intolerable, and you might even get yourself into the position this friend of mine was in that I was telling you about, where he literally believed that you were forbidden by God to ever feel pride in any degree about anybody for any reason. Well, there's two sides of this story and two extremes, and they're equally wrong. So, let's go to 2 Corinthians. After these people have repented, after they've changed their minds, after they've humbled themselves, what does Paul now say about arrogance and bragging and boasting? 2 Corinthians chapter 1, this is where it all began in the 1 Corinthian letter, was in chapter 1. Yeah, in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, look at verses 12 through 14. Our proud confidence is this: the testimony of our conscience, that in holiness and godly sincerity, not in fleshly wisdom, but in the grace of God, we have conducted ourselves in the world, and especially toward you. Now, brethren, is there any sin in that sentence? But if you declare your proud confidence, the testimony of your conscience, in holiness and godly sincerity, and not in fleshly wisdom, but the grace of God, that you personally have conducted yourselves in the world, and especially toward fellow saints, exactly the way you should, so you have proud confidence about it. Is there any sin? There's not. So, there are two very different sides to this story. Pride is not inherently evil. Pride is a necessary thing if you're going to succeed as a Christian before God. But what about your pride? It must be managed. It must be disciplined and controlled. It must be very carefully practiced. It must be appropriately manifested in the right circumstances. But it is not to be denied as an inherently evil thing, never to be practiced. Look at chapter 5 in 2 Corinthians in verse 12. We are not again commending ourselves to you, but are giving you an occasion to be proud. What are the next two words? Of us. Paul lived that perfect life that he just expressed his proud confidence in, so that the response would be what from the Corinthians? Pride in him, which is fine, that you may have an answer for those who take pride in what? Appearance, but not in what? Oh, if I take pride in appearance, then there is sin, division, and I'm on the way to a fall. But if I take pride not in heart, but in someone else, then what? Why, this is great. Look at chapter 7, verse 4. There'll be two of them in chapter 7 if you just want to then make a comment and add a second verse. They're kind of unrelated, though. So two of them in chapter 7, verse 4. Great is my confidence in you. Great is my boasting on your behalf. I'm filled with comfort. I'm overflowing with joy in all our affliction. Well, how had the Corinthians responded to the first letter? Perfectly. And so now his boasting is what? It's great. There's great boasting going on. But who's it in? Somebody else. Now look at verse 14. In 7:14, he says, if in anything I have boasted to him about you, I was not put to shame. But as we spoke all things to you in truth, so also our boasting before Titus proved to be in truth. Brethren, when you're bragging on your brethren, then, brethren, that's a great and good thing. Should be huge. Then it's appropriate. Two more. Chapter 9, verses 2 and 3. I know your readiness, of which I boast about you to the Macedonians, that Achaia has been prepared since last year, and your zeal has stirred up most of them. I've sent the brethren that are boasting about you may not be made empty in this case, that as I was seen, you may be prepared. Self-evident, the longer one, and I'll close quickly, I've only got 60 seconds. Chapter 10, verses 8 through 17. 10, 8 through 17. Even if I should boast somewhat further about our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I shall not be put to shame. I do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters. For they say, here's one of the false accusations made against him, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive, his speech contemptible. Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also indeed when present. For we are not bold to class or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves, but when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are without what? Understanding. But we will not boast beyond measure. In other words, I will boast proper measure. We will not boast beyond measure, but within the measure of the sphere which God appointed us as a measure in reach, even as far as you. We are not overextending ourselves, as if we did not reach to you. We were the first to come even as far as you in the gospel of Christ. Not boasting beyond measure, that is, in other men's labors, but with the hope that as your faith grows, we shall be within our sphere enlarged even more by you, so as to preach the gospel even to the regions beyond you, and not to boast in what has been accomplished in the sphere of another. But he who boasts, let him boast in the Lord. For not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commands. So you've heard that. And I hope you've seen the balance. Does Paul spend as much time boasting as he does condemning boasting? He does. Does Paul spend as much time commending boasting as he does condemning boasting? Yes, he does. So, is it inherently evil? But does it yet go before a fall? Should you practice it about others and with proper measure, even about yourself, but never beyond that measure? Judge righteous judgment, brethren, it's the way Jesus put it, and you'll have this thing nailed. Thanks for your time.